So Joe Diffie passed away. Literally saw it just now. So I thought I would get on and say a few things and also put back the episode we did with him just a few months ago. I was lucky enough to have become buds with Joe over the last few years, especially the last couple of years. He first came on the radio show in 2013, which to me was a big deal because it's always awesome getting to hang out with the people that you liked when you were a kid. And that was definitely the case with Joe Diffie. I just got a text from a country singer just now who said, dude, Joe Diffie, so sad. I'm really glad he was on your podcast. It was the only long form interview that I heard from him. So we're going to play it back if you didn't get to hear it. And we also did this around Christmas time, I think, last year, right?
Yeah, in December.
Yeah, so we weren't really able to promote it as much as we would have liked to as well. So I hope you like it. Just a couple things before we get into it. Joe Diffie died at 61. And this is a few days after his positive coronavirus test came out. Just made a bunch of hits throughout the 90s. By the way, I don't know what day you're listening to this, but he did die Sunday due to complications related to COVID-19. You know, there's a lot of quotes here. I'll go because with these funerals or with people dying during coronavirus time, what really sucks is you can't get a bunch of people together to appreciate and pay respects. So that stinks because, you know, you want to show that you love people, you want to be there for them. Joe Diffie was a Grand Ole Opry member. He was a Grammy winner. We're going to go through some of his catalogs in a second. But to me, he was just a good old normal dude who, whenever he put out his new record, he saved me his very first vinyl. And he wrote on it, 1 of 500. So our condolences out to the whole family there. You know, when Joe came over and did the Bobbycast, I think he brought his whole family with him.
Yeah.
It was like
they were in here.
Yeah. It was like an audience. And his daughter was a huge fan of the show. Mm-hmm. You know, I was able to play the Opry with Joe a couple times. It sucks. It does. It really sucks. There's really nothing more to the point except it sucks. My favorite song from Joe Diffie was Prop Me Up Beside the Jukebox. I know I got to sing it with him on the radio show because I was like, Joe, I love it, bud. Let me sing it with you. And he was like, all right. So this is my favorite on the video. We talk about it coming up. John Deere Green. Dang, everybody knows this one. On a hot summer night, he wrote Billy Bob Love Charlie. Pickup Man. I met all my wives. The traffic jams are just something women like about a pickup man. Third Rock from the Sun, which is one of those weird songs that I learned every word to as a kid because there were so many words. And I was so proud of myself that I could sing all of it. Whenever I come on the radio, I play it cool, I'd be like, oh, I like this song, but I know every word. And I wouldn't look at them, I'd just be singing it. And hopefully they'd appreciate that I knew every word of the song. And then Ships That Don't Come In. Here's to all the soldiers who have ever died in vain. The insane locked up in themselves. The homeless down on Main. To those who stand on empty shores and spit against the wind. And those who wait forever. Don't come in. Rest in peace, Joe. Loved you as a kid. Loved you again as an adult. Probably loved you all that time in the middle, too. That sucks. It sucks. It sucks. Here is the Bobbycast I did with Joe Diffie that I was so excited for that I did it on vacation during Christmas. And I was like, holy crap. Hope you enjoy it. Share it with your friends. And here you go. All right, welcome to episode 217 with a guy I really like and been a big fan of for years, Joe Diffie. Good to hear you. Good to see you.
Well,
all
thank
that
you.
Stuff.
Thank you. You as well.
You know, I was looking at, I know most of the stuff about you. Like, I've been a fan. Before we've been able to be friends, I was just a massive fan of you growing
That's
up.
That's awesome, man.
And so, as I kind of went on the deep dive, because I always like to find out, you know, what do I not know about the people that are coming over to the house?
Right.
Right. Listen to this. I don't know if you even knew this.
Oh, Lord. Here we go.
On this day, December 16th, 1994, you had the number one song on the Billboard Country chart with Pickup Man. It was your longest lasting number one, having spent 4 weeks at number one from December 94 to January 95. Did you know that was today?
No, I didn't know it was today. I knew the rest of that, but
yeah.
I didn't realize the date of it. That's pretty cool.
On this day in 1994.
I counted as four number ones.
So. Yeah. That's, so, for example, Luke Combs just spent 3 weeks at number one. And that's for a song, the last 3 weeks at number one, especially today, is a really big deal. Yeah. When you have a song that's number one for 4 weeks in 1994, what's really the vibe of that?
Well, I mean, it was unusual because back then, you know, they put out a lot more songs. The frequency of, you know, you put out four or five songs a year, and now you might have one song that stays on the charts, lingering there at some point for almost a year, you know. So that was kind of the weird part. We had to wait to see how long it was going to stay number one before we could put out another record. So
did you feel like that song was going to be a number one song?
I knew it from the instant I heard it.
Really?
I really did, yeah. I don't know why, just something about it. I just, you know.
Have you been able to name and nail most of your big songs from the first time you heard them?
Yeah, pretty much. There was a couple that I didn't, like John Deere Green. I hated it when I first heard it.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, because the demo, and now this is it's a long saga, but when I first heard it, it was done by the writer named Dennis Lindy. And he had a very eclectic sound and voice, and he did all his own demos at his house. So it had like a Juice harp playing, and he's like, ding, 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 ding. And I was like, what the heck is that? You know, and then my producer, he said, ignore the demo part. I have to add right now that I subsequently loved all of Dennis Lindy's demos. They were so cool after you kind of figured out what was happening, you know. But anyway, my producer said, listen to the words I was like, man, I just don't like it at all. He goes, well, he said, I think this is a hit. And I said, well, we can try it. You know, we'll go in the studio and cut it. And if it doesn't work out, then we can scrap it, you know. So luckily it worked out.
So you go in and at what point? Is it during the session? Is it during the tracking? When do you go, oh, there might be something here with John Deere Green?
Yeah, when we tracked it, you know, because obviously it was a lot different than the demo, you know. So, yeah, once we started tracking, I was like, yeah, that is a pretty good song right there.
What song of yours, when you play it, gets the biggest response?
John Deere Green.
And you know what's funny about that? It was not a number one song.
I know. Isn't that weird?
It's, you know, I talk with a lot of young artists now, and they're like, I just want that number one. I'm like, I get it. You do. But, and Keith Urban and I have talked about this, where a lot of his biggest songs weren't number one.
Right. Isn't that weird? I, you know, of course, back in those days, I mean, there were several, there were like four or five different charts. So I think it did go number one in one of them. I don't know which one, but yeah, that is a strange phenomenon. Some songs that do go number one don't sell as well, et cetera, you know. So
for me, when I think about your music, like my favorite song is "Prop Me Up."
Hell yeah!
And that was not a number one song.
Yeah.
On the radio chart.
Right.
I mean, when I think of Joe Diffie, this is the song for me. I know every word. I remember when it came out. I bought the CD, and I memorized every word so I could sing all of it. I did that and Third Rock, because Third Rock is a little harder because the words were a lot faster.
Right, right.
But this is the song for me that if someone's like, what's your favorite? Matter of fact, when you came in, I was like, Joe, you got to play Prop Me Up.
Right.
And you did. And again, it peaked at number three on the radio chart.
Yeah, it's weird.
Right?
It was a big record for me. You know.
The video, though, for this song
is
what I really remember from the song as well. Because back in the day, we used to really watch CMT for music videos.
Right, right. A lot, yeah. You know what I remember about that video, mostly filming the video? It was so hot. Man, it was, and they had these buckets of like sea breeze. Remember sea breeze? It was kind of like a facial cleanser or some kind of deal. And it was like, but it had like a aromatic kind of effect. And they were dabbing all of us with that stuff, you know. But I just remember it was so hot. And plus the dead guy.
He
was so funny, man.
That to me is those two songs. And I didn't, again, as I started deep diving, I was like, man, my favorite two songs, number five and a number three.
Yeah.
And you say that John Deere Green gets the biggest. When you do your set list, what do you start with? What's the first song?
Third Rock from the Sun.
You come out high energy,
yeah.
Huh? Which, this was a number one song for you.
Yeah.
I just would have a problem going out and doing the fast stuff quick, because then I'd be out of breath for the next three songs.
That has happened.
Yeah, so I'm like,
Especially, I'll tell you where it happens nerves me a lot is if I'm, you know, on the Opry. For some reason, it makes you nervous. And, boy, if you ever get backwards on your breathing in that song, you are screwed. I mean, it's over, you know.
Tell me about this song, Third Rock. So you heard it. Were you like, well, what's this about? It's like what?
I always thought it was like a little mini movie, you know, which I heard a lot of songwriters say you try to do, right? Try to write a little 3-minute movie, you know. But honestly, this was one that, I mean, even though I liked it, there was the same publisher had played 2 different songs for us, and I liked the other one better, actually. And so I ended up getting both of them. I had to do a little wheeling and dealing. Some guy, apparently, I can't verify this, but I was told this, Garth Brooks wanted Third Rock as well, so...
And how did you get Third Rock? What was the wheel?
We told them we'd cut both. We would do both of their songs.
Do you know what the other song was?
It was called something about.
If you're
the
having
radio.
To think, I guess it really was never a
single.
Well,
it was never a single. Yeah, I'm just.
Did you put it on the record?
Yeah, yeah, it's on there.
I'm gonna run through your number ones real quick. Let's do Home.
Yeah,
your first one, 1990.
Yeah, the debut single.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
First song out, and you go number one.
My first 6. Went number one, apparently.
6 in a row.
Yeah.
So do you think after, let's say, 2 or 3 that you have it figured out?
You know what? I felt a little bit like a rube. I was so naive about the whole process. I mean, even though I kind of knew about stuff, but man, you know, when you start off like from what I did, I mean, I was on the road 300 days a year. And so I didn't really have time to think about stuff. I was busy, you know, traveling and doing shows and doing meet and greets and all that stuff, you know.
So what brought you to Nashville? Meaning, I know the music, I know the thought of country music, but there's always something where you get that push or you get kind of the itch.
Well, I got laid off from my job. I was working at a foundry back in Duncan, Oklahoma, and they shut the plant down and laid us all off. And, you know, and I'd been singing little VFWs and,
how old were you?
Oh, 20. I moved to Nashville when I was 28.
Oh, so a little bit older.
Yeah, yeah.
Compared to like the 19, 22 year olds are moving here now.
Exactly.
So you get laid off.
Yeah, and I said, and I had been to Nashville once before with my aunt and a friend of mine. We did this little thing as a trio, and we came in, and my aunt had known somebody here in Nashville, and so. Anyway, we met with them, and I fell in love with the city then, but I didn't have opportunity because I still had a job at the time, you know. But when I got laid off, I was like, well, you know what? I think I'm just going to try it. So I just loaded up everything I could get in this whole beat-up car I had, and off I went.
So at home, you know, you're playing around bars. Are you playing around bars at home at all?
Not a lot, honestly. My background was more of I sang in a gospel group. Then I went from that to a bluegrass group. I played bluegrass for about 6 years with this group called Special Edition.
Were you known as the guy that was doing music while working at the plant by your workers?
Yeah.
By your coworkers?
Yeah, they'd always ask me to sing, you know.
Would you ever sing at work?
I don't remember.
Just probably gather them around and be like, all right, boys.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they'd sing that song, you know, whatever.
Isn't it funny how the things at the time that seem... And this happened over my career, my life too, were really, I put finger quotes up, unfortunate things that happened to us turn out to really be blessings.
Dude, blessing, the biggest blessing ever, yeah. Because if I hadn't got laid off, I probably would have never left there, you know, so.
When you get laid off, do you remember how that happened? Did your boss, your foreman come in and go, all right, you're done?
No, it was just more of I got a phone call, I think. And they said, yeah, plant shut down. Don't go out there. So.
And then immediately do you go, all right, time to go to Nashville. Like, was it kind of in the chamber already?
No, it took a couple of months, you know, of drawing unemployment. And I thought, well, you know, I might as well think of something. I had a good friend of mine. We used to discuss things. He moved to Dallas and became an accountant. And, you know, and I said, he said, yeah, you know, you ought to try music. You're really good at it and all that stuff. So.
And when you got to town, did you feel like you were good enough to get in the mix immediately?
I just felt really lost, honestly, when I first got to town, because I had just gotten divorced and I missed my kids, and you know, and I was just in this new place and I didn't have a place to live, and you know, and all this kind of stuff.
What'd you do? Where'd you move?
I finally moved in with a musician, a guy named David Greer, and we rented a house with no heater in it for about a year.
And what are you doing when you first moved to Nashville? Meaning, Are you out trying to meet people, play writer rounds? Like what happens with a new artist?
First
then?
With me, I needed some income, so I got a job. I knew a guy that worked at Gibson Guitars, and so they hired me out there to work in the warehouse, shipping guitars everywhere. So, and then after that, I would just do whatever I could. I'd go to showcases and, you know, just go hang out just to get out there and meet people, you know.
It's so interesting to hear about, because, like, I know you as the country music legend, but I love hearing, like, the origin story of the hustle, because I think so many people don't know that there's a hustle for everyone.
Man, I tell you what, there was days, seriously, you know, we didn't have anything in the house to eat. I mean, nothing. One time I had, I think I had 75 cents on me, and I went by, this is the funniest thing ever. I didn't know they didn't have White Castles in the Dunkin'. So I saw it said a hamburger, 25 cents. I thought, oh, yeah, I can, you know. So I stopped.
You can get a couple burgers.
Yeah. So I know. I said, the guy said, can I help you? I said, yeah, I'd like a hamburger, please. He goes, just one? I said, yeah. I didn't know they were, you know.
Tiny. Tiny. let's talk about this new project. So it's your first ever vinyl, right?
Yeah.
And so it's called Joe Diffie.
Right.
So tell me about this.
It's just a compilation of some number one songs we had, and we included a new song on it. I just always kind of wanted a vinyl, and it seems to be kind of coming back in fashion right now. So
where can people get it?
JoeDiffie.com/vinyl.
And each album is individually autographed and numbered.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You sign them all?
I did.
Or did you have the family sign them all?
No, I signed every stinking one.
They're all different signatures.
Dude, I was trying to be meticulous about it because, you know, you sign 500 of anything. After a while, you're like, man, I just don't care.
You know, I know at first because I was like, when I did my books, the first book I wrote, I was a little more like, I'm going to make everything so
After a while.
Then you're like, you know what? I think they're going to even like it. You start convincing yourself that sloppy's cooler.
Right,
too.
Right.
You're like, oh, it's more of my artsy side.
I even at one point, early in my career, because I was signing so many things, I was trying to come up with a faster way to sign my name, just like make a line and two dots or something, you know, but it never did look right.
You're living here. You and the same roommate. Are you still together while you're working at the guitar place?
For a little while. Okay. Then I moved out, and that's kind of how I got my first break, actually, in the music business was I moved out from him and moved in with this brother and sister who I worked with the brother at Gibson. And as it happened, a super, you know, talented songwriter guy lived next door, and his name's Johnny Neal, and so Johnny, you know, he can't see, he's blind. So my friend John that I moved in with, this is not getting too complicated.
No, we got plenty of time.
But John would take him to various things, to whatever he needed to do, sessions or whatever. And then one day John was working, and so Johnny asked me, he said, man, I need somebody. He called the house, you know, and I answered the phone. And he said, man, I need John to come get me. I said, well, he's not here. And he's like, well, man, I don't know what to do. And I said, well, I'll come get you. He goes, really? So I didn't really know him, you know. So anyway, we hit it off, and we started writing songs together. That's how I got my first publishing deal, was through him.
Was that a big deal to you to get paid to write songs?
Oh, Lord, yes, absolutely. They paid me $100 a week to write songs, and then they paid for, you know, the demos, the cost of the demos. So, and then that's how I got kind of discovered, you know, I guess, quote unquote.
Were you singing the demos?
I was singing the demos. So then, the musicians and other guys would be like, hey, I got to, well, come see my demo for me, you know. So,
what do you think about your vocal style? What do you think it was that attracted people to you?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. I don't know if I can answer that.
How would you classify yourself as a singer?
Well, pretty country, you know. I mean, but I'm able to kind of branch out. Like on this new project, I did a duet with an incredible singer named Mark Broussard.
I know Mark Broussard.
Yeah.
He's like Louisiana.
Oh, dude. Yeah. He's fantastic. And I just happened to, you know, I was listening to him as we were riding along on the bus. We listened to various music. And he happened to be in town recording same time I was. So we contacted him, and I just wanted to go meet him and say hi, you know. So I did, and he played me some of this new album he was working on. And so we became friends. You know, we're not like super close friends or anything. But then I said, man, I'm looking to do some duets. I said, would you be interested in singing something? He goes, yeah. So he came over, and we were looking at each other. We're like, well, what do we do? He goes, I don't know. I said, you know Pride and Joy? I said, kind of.
Steve Ray Vaughan, right?
Yeah. I said, I kind of do, yeah. And so we said, let's do that one. So we ended up doing that one.
That's pretty cool. Here it is right here.
She's my pride and joy. She's my sweet little baby. I'm a little lover boy. Well, I love my lady. She's long and lean. You mess with her, you see a man with me.
And that's on the new vinyl project.
Yeah.
Hey, Mike, will you see me from Louisiana?
He is. He's from Karen Crow.
Okay, I never want to mess it up, but like, yeah. I felt like he was.
Yeah, Karen Crow, Louisiana. Yeah.
And you grew up in Oklahoma?
Yeah, mostly.
When you were growing up, and is it true you were so good at all the sports that they named you like athlete of the year at your school?
Yeah.
Is that true?
That's the old days, but yeah.
What was your sport?
I was probably the best at football. I played it was a small school, you know, so.
Played both ways. We did
never,
in my school too.
Really, yeah, never left the field, really. You know, I was a deep guy on punts and kickoffs, and then I also was, like, you know, I never left the field, so.
Are you still a big football fan?
Oh, yeah.
Who's your team?
Well, I mean, I like the pros. I like the Titans, and, of course, the Cowboys. That's who I grew up around, was near the Cowboys. So, college team, Oklahoma, OU.
Yeah, big Sooner fan.
Yeah.
So did you watch the Heisman ceremony?
I did not. I was working.
Jalen got third.
He got third.
Great season.
Yeah.
But OU's in it. They're playing LSU.
I know. They're in the top four.
It's four versus one.
That's going to be a tough game, really. That's going to be a real
hard game. It's going to be a real tough game.
Yeah, LSU is loaded.
Well, so you're a good football player. You're a punt returner, huh?
Well, yes.
Ish?
Ish, yeah.
I returned a few punts. And I'll tell you what I did not like was standing there vulnerable as that ball's coming down.
I know.
And you can just feel without even seeing, you know how if you're in a room, Joe, and you know somebody's looking at
Absolutely.
You?
Absolutely.
You don't have to look up to feel someone's
right.
eyes on you.
Exactly.
But you're imagining that with 9 or 10 guys coming at you hard.
Right.
Same kind of feeling.
And you're like trying to judge, do I catch
do
it?
Do I run?
Do I wave? Yeah. Yeah.
Once
it's harder than it looks, I guarantee you that.
Yeah, because you have to have tremendous focus, right? Yeah. And once I didn't fair catch it, I thought, I'm gonna just take off with this ball. Thought I had some space. And the ball's coming down, and I get a little alligator arm, and it hits my hand, I bobble it, and it's on the ground. And it was the only time that I really lunged for a fumble in my because I mostly play wide receiver.
Yeah.
And I didn't return a lot of punts, especially after this story here. But I botched the ball, and I was like, I got to go dive for it. And diving for a fumble was, I think, the most physical part of it. Because it was just bam, bam,
everybody's piling on, man.
And diving. Yeah. And I was on the bottom. And I was like, Lord. I'm done.
You ever hear those guys scream on the bottom, you know, because they're down there and then something's happening to them?
Oh, yeah.
You hear that terrified
people
scream.
Grab nuts. Twist. And it's a whole thing.
Yeah, it's a whole deal.
So you play football? You play basketball?
Basketball.
Baseball?
Baseball. Track. Golf.
Five-sport guy, huh? Yeah. Did you think about playing in college at all?
I thought about it, but I never did get any scholarship offers for football. I actually had some small college offer me a sight unseen basketball scholarship, oddly enough, and I wasn't that great. I was okay, but, you know. But I have a cousin that played at Oklahoma State, and he was younger than I. And so I asked him, I said, do you think I could play there? He goes, oh, absolutely. There's
really?
No doubt. So. But I never get any scholarship offers. I had a couple of coaches in small colleges ask me to walk on, and if it worked out, they'd give me a scholarship. But I never did.
So you're in Nashville, and so you're driving Jimmy, right?
Johnny Neal.
Johnny, excuse me. There's John and Johnny.
Yeah.
You're driving Johnny Neal.
Right.
And so you go pick him up the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And then how does that relationship turn into something? Because you guys start writing together.
Well, I had bugged him a couple times that I'd love to write with him. You know, of course, I'm just a newbie. You know, I didn't really know much about it. And he kind of gave me the old brush off, you know. Maybe one day we'll, maybe, you know. But we just hit it off. We had a few minutes to, like, actually talk and you know, goofing around. And so he said, well, come on over. So we wrote a couple songs And he had a little studio at his house so we turned those demos in, and his publisher at the time signed me as well. So that's kind of how it got started. And I don't think John and I ever got a couple of cuts. I got one on the Forrester Sisters.
Yeah,
yeah. It's called "Come Hold Me," and then So then I started writing with another guy named Lonnie Wilson, great drummer, session drummer and writer and singer. And we had our first top five record with Holly Dunn. It was There Goes My Heart Again was the name of it. So
a top five song back in late 80s. Did you make any money off that?
Dude, I went to the mailbox. I never seen that much money in my life.
Really?
It was like the first installment, you know? Yeah. I was like, I got to write more songs. It's pretty cool.
And how long do those checks keep coming?
Oh, they had the first year is pretty good, and after that it tapers off significantly and almost down to nothing, you know.
And you're cutting these demos and people are interested in your singing style, which we were on a minute ago. So when did it become a thing where you go, okay, I think it's time for me to try to be an artist?
Well, I mean, that's kind of what I had in mind all along, but I just knew that songwriting would be a good avenue to meet people and to, you know, just because it was part of the music business, such a significant part. But I always had that in my mind, being an artist. But I didn't really have any way that I knew. It takes somebody to promote you, basically. And so I started doing demos for these couple of guys, and they knew they were good friends with Bob Montgomery, who was at Epic Records at the time. And so after they played him some demos, so he called me over and met with me and said, how would you like to have a record deal? And I'm like, so yeah, it's pretty cool.
So that was the conversation that kind of changed it all for you. The how would you like to have a record deal conversation.
Yeah, exactly.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, he said, man, I wanted to do this my whole life. And he said, no, you haven't. I was like, I looked at him. I was like, what do you mean? He goes, well, you haven't lived your whole life yet. I said, okay, one of those guys.
How long from when you were laid off until you got your record deal?
3 years.
So you spent a couple months figuring it out. You moved here. You wrote. So 3 years from there to there.
Right.
Do you feel like you matured a lot as an artist in that time?
In those 3 years?
Yeah.
Probably. Just from the sheer volume of demos and stuff I did. You know, they're all various styles. And so you kind of had to learn to do that kind of, you know, just so, yeah, I think so.
You know, a lot of the artists and a lot of my friends, too, that are here, that you kind of come in classes. You don't do it on purpose. But when you move to town, you start meeting other people that moved to town around the same time.
Right.
And that kind of becomes your pack that you grow up with because you're all on a similar level.
Exactly.
When you move here, like, who is some of the folks in your class?
Well, let's see. There was Trisha Yearwood. There was T. Graham Brown. There was, Garth was singing some demos. I don't know if many of the other ones were, as you know, but I mean, the same guys that are, you know, in my generation are... You know, of course, the Mark Chestnuts and Tracy Lawrence and those guys, you know. So,
what was Trisha doing? Was she working at Mary Tyler Moore Music, or was she singing demos?
I'm not sure. I had only met her a few times, and we sang a couple of demos together.
Really?
Yeah, which is cool. And then I got her to sing one, a chick song, quote-unquote, that I had written. So she sang it for me. So we've been friends ever since.
So whenever you hear or you see someone like Garth or Trisha back then, were you like, man, there's something special about them? Like you think, or is it just the land of giants where everybody's good?
Most everybody was good. You know, you felt like it was just kind of a crapshoot. You know, somebody's going to get lucky and get that deal and something happen. I'll tell you a weird story, and people might think this is really odd. I've done this twice in my life. I went to a showcase where it was Garth, and it was at Douglas Corner. And I was sitting around having a beer, you know, talking to some friends of mine. And I look up, and he's playing and up there. And I saw an aura around him. I'm not kidding you. So I started looking around the room. I thought, well, the lights got to be weird. That's something weird going on here. And I couldn't find any reason that he had a blue aura around him. I swear to goodness, it was the weirdest thing. And the other time was my wife, Tara. I saw her. She had an aura.
Now, do you think that that's in your eyes? Do you think that you saw something special?
I didn't know what it was. I saw it. And I asked, do y'all see that? And everybody else was like, no. And I'm like, oh, man, that's okay. I'm going to keep quiet here. So,
did you ever talk to Garth in the early days? Were you guys buddies at all?
A few times. We weren't super close or anything, you know.
Who were your buds? Musically, who were your buds? And who did you like tour with? Who did you like to tour with?
Well, I've had a lot of them. I like... all of the people I've toured with.
But let's do this. Mount Rushmore of your favorite tour buddies. Four of them. You only get four.
Oh, gosh. That's hard, man.
It is. I'm putting the screws to you, Joe.
I mean, of course, I toured with Garth. some, didn't do a whole lot. We he used to open shows for me, oddly enough. Yeah, and so, but we did that, and I opened some shows for him after that. Of course, you know, one of my closest buddies is Mark Chestnut, and, you know, he's always really consistent. And, gosh, who else would it be that I toured with? You know, Travis Tritt's an incredible singer. Did a year-long tour with him.
How was that? Because I know Travis a little bit, and he's at times, is very in your face.
Yeah.
And at times is super warm.
Yeah.
How was you and Travis's relationship?
It was good.
Yeah.
It was very good. Yeah. We just had a good time. As me, Travis, myself, and Leroy Parnell were out there, and it was a good package. You know, we had a lot of fun.
You got one more on the Mount Rushmore.
Oh gosh. Oh.
You got Garth Chestnut,
Tracy Lawrence. You know, Tracy's always good. You know, when you go see him. I'm trying to think who else I toured with. I've done so many, you know, various packages here and there that I can't even remember them.
You ever put a kid opening and that kid turned out to be a big star way later on?
Let me think. I almost said Brad Paisley, but I'm not sure that ever happened. You know, because I see some. I met a kid the other night that came up and he opened for me and Chestnut were doing an acoustic thing, and he came up and sang, and this kid was really good. You know,
what was his name? Remember?
I don't remember.
It's probably is me.
It was you?
Yeah, it's me. It's me.
Some of the little place in Texas we were at, and man, we got him up to sing, and he was like, he nailed it. He sang "Is It Cold in Here?" My song. So
here's another number one. This is "If the Devil Danced."
If the devil danced in empty pockets, he'd have a ball in mine. Well, he said, "Friend."
A little bit of that Texas swing in that song.
Yeah.
That's is that your second number one song?
I think that was like the third one.
Yeah,
I believe.
So, home hits. You have a number one. What was the second big one for you?
If You Want Me To.
Okay.
If You Want Me To. And then I think Devil. Actually, it may have been New Way to Laugh and Old Flame. I can't remember. I've lost track.
Pickup Man, which jam. Where do you put this in the set list?
Oh, it's fourth or fifth.
It's got to be interesting to put together a set list for you because you have so many big
songs.
It's
hard. It's really hard. And I remember touring with George. I got the final with George Strait. Put him on that Mount Rushmore.
You toured with George Strait?
Yeah, when I first started.
What year was that?
It had to have been 91 or 2, somewhere in that range.
What is a tour like with you and George Strait?
Well, I didn't really get to see George very much. You know, he was kind of a private person and you know, and he didn't really come to sound checks or anything. So, I mean, I saw him occasionally, and he's super nice, man. He just, I just remember I was pretty tickled when he finally, you know, said, "Hey, Joe, how you doing?" I'm like, "All right, George knows my name now." So,
Bigger Than the Beatles.
Yeah.
Here's this one right here, number one for you.
They got love bigger than the Beatles, wild and free like a rolling stone. They got love.
You know, for me, whenever I would hear you as a kid, I always felt like you were smiling when you were singing. Like that.
That is part of it. You know, when you're trying to, I mean, you do think of that. You try to emote, you know, put your feelings into the songs you're singing. So, yeah.
I always felt like, when I think about your songs, I always think, man, Joe Dippy sounds like he's having a good time.
Yeah, absolutely.
That would be if I were to, like, talk about, if someone's like, "What's Joe Dippy sound like?" I would say, "It sounds like he's smiling, like he's having fun singing about country."
Yeah.
Say, how do you feel about these artists like the Luke Combs? I'm setting you up here, but the guys that are really super traditional style again.
Yeah.
Excite you?
I love it. Yeah. I mean, country's always been a little bit cyclical, you know, and it goes from one thing to another, kind of vacillates back and forth. So I love Luke. I got to. Along with Vince Gill and a couple other folks, got to induct him into the Grand Ole Opry recently, so that was pretty cool.
Whenever the Al Dean song 1994 came out, and the famous lyric is Joe Diffie. Did you know this was coming?
Yeah. I actually had heard, it started off somebody contacting me and said, "Man, there's a song somewhere out there that has your name in it." I said, "Oh, really?" So somehow we got a copy of it. It was a demo. You know, Thomas Rhett was one of the writers on that. And so the first time I heard it was Thomas Rhett's version, you know. And it was a lot more kind of rap feeling than Jason's version. Jason has a lot more guitars and stuff. So, yeah, I just like me and my band members were sitting around. I said, here's that song. Got my name in it, apparently. So I put it in there and it had all that. We're looking at each other like, what the hell is that? You know, so.
Did they bring you out? Or wait, where was it? Were they doing this at an award show?
It was ACMs. They had the giant head.
Is that what it was? And I remember seeing it. That's what it was. It was the giant head.
It dropped out of the ceiling.
Yeah. Did you find when that song comes out that people were going, like younger kids, were like, who the heck is Joe Diffie?
Yeah.
Like 12-year-olds.
Dude, I'm that's a good setup for saying this, that because of Jason and Thomas Rick, because Thomas does that song in his show as well, you know. And so it's being heard by a lot of people, you know. And so our crowds have just been tremendous, and a lot more, you know, younger people, and they know every daggum word to every song, which is pretty amazing.
Back in the day, there was the TV commercial. I think they did Pickup Man. Pickup Man was used in a car truck commercial.
Ford truck commercial, yeah.
And did they redo the words a little bit in it?
Well, yeah. Or
did they get another singer, or what was it?
No, that was actually me on camera. It's the same one you're talking about. That commercial actually aired on the Super during the Super Bowl. So
that's when that commercial aired?
Yeah.
You were in the Super Bowl commercial?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Isn't that cool? I got more people though that had no idea who I was that saw that. They were like, hey, you're that pickup guy, you know?
So people would recognize you for being the pickup guy from the commercial more than...
Oh, because I was on camera too.
Yeah. But they would see you from the... It's interesting because I was talking to Brad Paisley a couple weeks ago, and I said, hey, what are people like coming up to you as the insurance guy?
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, a lot of people don't even know that I do music if they don't know country music, and they only know me from the Nationwide commercials.
Yeah.
That's right, Mike?
Yeah.
And so people were coming up to you and you're the Super Bowl commercial guy?
Yeah.
Is that a nice payday to do a Super Bowl commercial?
Yes. Dang. It's very nice.
I love paydays. See, I grew up poor.
That song, though, has made me probably more money than any of the other songs I've had. And I didn't write the song. A couple of friends of mine wrote it. And so they get paid as well, you know, but for the royalty publishing and all that stuff. So, but it was also an Applebee's commercial. And
was it their, like, Cars to Go service?
It was like, yeah, you pick up. Yeah, they changed the lyrics on it. And I'll tell you the miracle of modern stuff, you know. I had a studio in my house, and so somehow we got my booking agents got they said that they were interested in using Pickup Man as a part of an Applebee's commercial, and so they sent me a CD of it, just the music and the lyrics changed it, that they had rewritten it basically, and so I just stuck it in the thing, read the lyrics, sang it down. Took me about an hour, and I sent it back. I thought it was going to be like a presentation or a demo for them, and they used it.
Oh, they
That's
did.
What they used, and they kept renewing it, man. It was like, this is great. I said, can I get some more of those commercials?
Is that where it is, like in the sync stuff?
Boy, yeah.
Yeah.
If you can get in one of those deals, that's a pretty good deal.
What's touring like for you now?
It's great.
You doing a bunch of shows?
A lot, yeah. I've been working a lot, and probably you know, just staying really busy, which is really good. I like working, you know. We were talking earlier that the travel part gets a little old, you know. You get tired from that. But, I mean, you know, getting to sing, do, play around, mess around all the time. It's like I told my guys, it's like we're on a big camping trip all the time, you know. So we have fun.
You worked in an oil field for a while.
I did.
You drove a truck to pump cement. Is that true?
Yeah.
What was that work like?
It sucked. Yeah. It was for a company called Halliburton. And oddly enough, who were headquartered, they used to be headquartered in Duncan, Oklahoma. But I had to move to Alice, Texas to work for them because I had an uncle that worked for them. And I didn't do that for very long. I was there for about, I don't know, 3-4 months or so. And it was like you're gone all the time. And the pay was not that great. And so I just decided I didn't like that. So I moved back to Duncan and got a job in that foundry. So
what about you going to medical school?
If you had asked me when I was a kid, that's what I always wanted to be, was a doctor. And I used to read medical books, and I followed my parents around reading them facts and figures on that kind of stuff, you know.
What'd your mom and dad do?
They were both teachers. My dad did a little bit of everything. He had his own welding company for a while. He had a repossession company for a while, which he didn't.
So
really
he was
like.
Having to repo cars.
Yeah, he didn't like that. That
like in the middle
long.
Of the night,
yes.
Like go and wow, that's a dangerous.
It was very dangerous. He got shot at a couple of times. He said he didn't like that. So
Wow.
Yeah. So he actually built, since he was a welder, he built this rig on the like a hook that was hydraulic, and it would come out of the back of the pickup, and the tailgate would lower down, and he would just back up to the cars and pick them up and drive off with them.
That's a crazy line of work, Joe.
It is, man. Yeah.
And thinking as we get as kids, we see adults do things, and we're like, that's just kind of normal.
Right.
But as you get to be an adult, and you see other adults repoing and people shooting at them, that's crazy.
Yeah, he didn't last long with that. He didn't like that at all. So, and plus, you know, you're having to, and he just the human element of it. A lot of people that couldn't, you know, they were behind on their payments through whatever. Some of them were just bums, and some of them just lost their jobs or something, you know, or were ill. And he'd have to, the bank would, you know, tell him to go get this car, you know. So he had to work with the bank a lot. And so he didn't like that either, because people had to come. He had to tow it to a yard, and then people came to the yard, and he had to be out there while they gathered their belongings out of their repossessed car, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, so he didn't like that.
1993, you were inducted into the Grand Ole Opry.
Yeah.
That's a real special thing.
That was one of my highlights of my career. I consider it, you know.
How did you get told you were going to be in the Opry?
Kind of the same way I got told by a record deal. I went out to the Opry and met with the guy who, I can't remember his name right now, he was the head of it back then, and I don't know why we were even out there. I was out there with my managers, and he goes, well, how would you like to be a member of the Grand Ole Opry? I'm like, yeah. So that really, that's how I got my record deal and the Grand Ole Opry thing. So it's pretty cool.
Pretty low-key invitation.
It was very low-key.
Both. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it true that your parents said you could sing harmonies when you were 3 years old?
Yeah.
Now, you probably can't remember. You remember three?
Yeah.
You do remember three?
I remember singing in we had a pickup, and I had two sisters, and so we would all be five of us be in the truck, and to keep us occupied and you know, from screaming at each other, they would sing little simple songs, you know, little kid songs, and we'd sing along with them. So.
And at three, you could harmonize?
Uh-huh. I just heard it. It was in my head. I could hear it.
Were you always a really good singer as a seven-year-old, in church or wherever you were singing? Were you always the...
I guess, you know, it's hard to judge it, you know.
I guess, were you rewarded for your singing at a very young age? Were people telling you, wow,
yeah,
Joe?
Yeah. I mean, I remember my aunt got me up in front of, with her band, and I got up and sang You're My Sunshine or something like that, you know. So it was pretty cool.
What was it like in the 90s touring with no internet and no cell phone and no Google Maps? Do you ever just end up with the bus in a wrong town?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, you would?
Oh, yeah. We, you know, of course, you have to get the map out, and then you had to know. Even our satellite, we did have a satellite dish, but the bus had to be stopped, and you had to, like, physically enter in, get the atlas out, and figure out your latitude and your longitude and enter those coordinates in, and then it would raise up. Yeah.
Would you ever get somewhere, and because there weren't cell phones, realize there was no show happening anymore? Or
no.
Like, you get there and like, nah, we try to get a hold of you, but no. The carrier pigeon, you know.
No, we unfortunately never had that happen. But
what kind of country music artists are you drawn to now?
I guess I have a tendency to lean more towards the country or the country side of things, you know, which you know, so I enjoy Luke and, you know, Brad Paisley and a couple other guys that I think are good singers, you know.
Growing up, who was your favorite?
Oh, man. Well, it'd probably have to be George Jones. I mean, that's who I emulated. So, you know, learned a lot by emulating him. But, I mean, I had a whole range of, you know, of course, I had the regulars that everybody mentions, Haggard, Jones, Johnny Cash, you know, Conway. There was, you know, a whole plethora of those people, but I, you know, I actually like, I loved Loretta Lynn and Dolly Parton as well, you know, and Connie Smith, and so I heard a lot of those.
Being from Oklahoma, and I'll preface it with my story. I'm from Arkansas, so it was Johnny Cash and Conway Twitty, and listen, Wichita Lyman was so big too. Oh, yeah. Anybody from Arkansas was a big deal to us because there weren't a lot of us
right. Who
made it on any sort of national stage.
Yeah.
Being from Oklahoma, who was it that you looked at and was like, wow, like this is one of our guys doing it or one of our girls doing it?
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, they aren't that much older than I am, but I mean, Reba and Vince, they were already involved in doing stuff before I ever moved to Nashville, so that was pretty cool to see that. And, you know, you kind of take that and, you know, feel good about it.
Man, that's crazy. Like, I did the... Mike, what was the thing in D.C. I did with Reba?
Kennedy Honors.
I did the Kennedy Honors for Reba. Yeah. I got to go. I did went up and did 10 minutes of stand-up. And there was like six of us that presented to Reba. It was me and Brooks and Dunn and Kristen Chenoweth and Kelly Clarkson. But anyway, so I go up and I'm doing comedy. But I'm also talking through, as I'm doing comedy, Reba's Oklahoma Life.
Oh, yeah.
Where
yeah.
she was, it was, you know, doing working the rodeos.
Right.
Like singing the rodeos.
Yeah.
And, you know, to
I think that's how she got discovered.
Singing the national anthem at the rodeo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tex Ritter, I think, is the one.
Who for you saw you sing? I know you got a record deal, but who saw you randomly, if anyone, and they were like, man, I think there could be, like, you're actually pretty good there, Joe. Did you ever have one
well,
of those moments?
There was this old drunk guy at a bar in Warrego, Oklahoma. he threw $5 at me, said, son, you ought to move to Nashville. You're really good. So, yeah.
You ever see anybody cover your songs nowadays and you go, man, that's a really good version of that song?
I've heard a couple of them. Yeah, it sounds real good. You know, it's fun. It's fun to me to hear them, you know.
If you could pick one of your songs to be covered again now and to be made a hit again, which song would you like to see reborn?
That's a good question. Well, I know my favorite song is Ships That Don't Come In.
Oh, come on. I love that. Let me listen to that.
To all the soldiers who have ever died in vain. Insane locked up in themselves, the homeless down on Main.
So everybody listening right now, there's a lot of artists that listen to this podcast. Ships That Don't Come In, that's the cover to do.
Oh, it is, man. That's such a great song. I've told the writers, Dave Gibson and Paul Nelson, I said that song didn't need me, but it needed somebody to sing it because it's just such a great song. I think it could have been a hit with anybody, you know. So I was glad I got it.
Anybody cool ever come up to you that you're like, man, they're a fan of you, but you're like, that's really cool. They're a fan of me.
A lot. Some people I revere, you know. I mean, I was going to introduce myself to Merle Haggard one time at the ACMs, and I walked up, and he goes, Joe, how you doing, man? I'm a big fan of yours. I'm like, Merle Haggard knows my name. That just blows my mind, you know. Ronnie Millsap told me he was, you know, so. Yeah, that's a really special thing when somebody who you idolize tells you that, you know.
Can you go to dinner in Nashville or in Tennessee without being bothered?
Yeah, I mean, people are pretty cool. They really are. And I just always feel like it's really not a bother. I mean, all the time it ever even kind of gets under my skin a little bit is if I'm in the middle of eating.
You know, I often say if people are eating or with their kids.
Yeah.
Those are really the only two times, because otherwise, everyone knows what they signed up for.
Right. Yeah.
You're a public figure, but eating, like literal food on the table.
I have food, a fork in my hand, mm-hmm. eating something. Of course, people don't mean any harm by it, you know. In fact, George Jones and I were out to dinner one evening, and this lady came up, and we were in the middle of eating, and she comes up with her little boy, and she goes, I don't mean to bother you guys. And George goes, well, what are you doing it for then? He was teasing, of course, you know.
So what is it like to be a fan of George Jones and then here you are having dinner?
I know. I couldn't even talk to him. I didn't know what to even ask him.
I'm assuming he has to invite you.
Yeah, yeah.
And where did that relationship, how did it start?
Just from doing a couple shows together. And I sang on his hit song, I Don't Need Your Rocking Chair.
I don't need That's your rocking chair. Yeah, yeah, man. Yeah, yeah. Jared Tall or your Medicare.
That's the one, yeah. So I did
that.
That
was such a jam.
And that was one of the most special things, not only because of that, but I got to take my dad. I didn't tell him where we were going. He was, George Jones was his idol, you know. So I just took him. He said, where are we going? I said, just come on, you know. So I took him in there and he saw Alan Jackson, Clint Black, and all these people. He's like, what is this? What's going on here? Then the limo pulls up and George gets out. He was just, I never seen, he was speechless. He just was stunned by it, you know.
So that's cool really moment. Cool, right? Yeah. Like, yeah. Of all the moments, like getting to do things for the people that you care about,
yeah.
At least for me, has been like kind of the coolest
Absolutely.
Thing I've been able to do.
Absolutely.
That's pretty cool that you're a big fan of George Jones and then you're at dinner with George Jones.
Really, it took me a couple of times before I was able to even converse with him because I was so nervous and he was just such an icon in my eyes. But I found that later on, he's just so country, you know. He's like talking to your grandpa. He couldn't hear real good, you know. So you'd say something, and he'd go, what? You know, so then I got him to sing on a song with me, and it was really cool, too.
Did you ever meet Tammy?
Oh, yeah. Tammy was one. She loved my singing. She asked, you asked about that earlier. I forgot about Tammy. She was a huge fan of mine. In fact, I sang on, she did an album of duets with a lot of rock artists. And I think me and Winona were the only two country people she asked to be on there. So that was really neat to get sit there. I mean, you talk about bizarre. All of a sudden, I'm sitting there right next to Tammy Wynette. And we sang it live. We sang it down live. It was, you know, there was no overdubbing or punching in. It was that's what it was. So,
were you around when they were doing the tours of stars' homes, when they would actually drive by people's houses?
Yeah.
Which nowadays seems really weird.
It's a pain. It's a pain in the rear. You'd be out mowing your lawn.
So this would happen to you, right?
All the time, yeah.
So you're out mowing the yard. What happens?
Oh, you're all sweaty, and you know, and there they, you know, here there comes that bus full of people, and they are all taking pictures of you, and your sweat dripping off of you. You got grass all over you. You know, it's like, hi, how y'all doing? You know.
How would they find your house?
I don't know how. I don't know how they did it.
Because if they did that nowadays, that would be the weirdest.
Well, I actually made a request. I said, look, I mean, I said, not only it's bothering me, but it's bothering my neighbors as well to have these buses coming and stopping and, you know, everybody getting out and all this
stuff.
They
would get out of the bus.
A couple times they did, yeah. So.
And I guess it's not illegal.
No, I actually called and asked, is there any way we can make this stop? And they're like, nope. So, okay. So it was kind of weird. So after that, literally, I'd be out mowing the lawn or doing something outside, and I'd be watching because I knew about what time of day they came by. And so I just watched for them. I'd go hide, you know, run behind the shed.
Everybody check it out. Joe Diffie. Each album is individually autographed and numbered, and it's at joediffie.com/vinyl.
Correct.
But I'm sure if you just go to joediffie.com, there's also a link up there that says for the vinyl, right?
I'm sure, yeah.
If you can't spell vinyl. Because I'm going to be honest, not a great word to spell.
It's not.
V-I-N-Y-L.
Yeah.
Not the easiest.
Are you sure?
No, I'm not. I wouldn't bet any money on that. As long as there's a bar.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
A couple of great friends of mine wrote that. A guy named Gavin Griffin and Brian Keith Burns, who was in Trick Pony. And he played bass for me for like 7 years early in my career. And so they wrote this song. It just reminded me of Prop Me Up a little bit. So that's mostly the reason I did it.
With a lot of the music from when I was a kid in the 90s, where you have a bunch of your number one songs kind of re-emerging as a big deal, did that help your touring? 90s country, like, was it like...
Absolutely.
Was it like a whole new rebirth of touring for you?
Absolutely, yeah. Helped it tremendously. And like I say... with that advent of that song, you know, 1994, I got so many new fans and, you know, younger fans. It's really been pretty amazing to me.
Well, I'm super happy that you came by.
Thank you.
Good luck. Hope you sell so many of these vinyl records that you're so annoyed with having to sign them. That's the greatest problem to have.
Best problem in the world.
It is
right
the
there.
Best.
It
like,
is.
I would get so irritated signing these books, and I'd be like, I'm so happy to be irritated. It was the greatest irritation.
You got
to
sit. Sometimes, you know, you get a little biased or just worn out with things over time, and you kind of, it's good to get a little, check once in a while, just to kind of, a little gut check and say, okay, wait a minute, I'm doing the best, I got the best job in the world, I could be out roofing a house.
And I used to do that.
You know, or.
I could be back on doing clean, I used to do cleanup from roofing houses, which is even worse than roofing houses.
Yeah, right, so I'm just so lucky and so blessed, I got a great family, you know, and. So, great friends. So, it's a pleasure for me.
Well, you're always welcome. I got a Christmas card from you.
All right. Yes.
Did you know that?
I did. Yes.
I felt like I was giving him news, Mike. He was like, oh, you got a Christmas card. I got a Christmas card from you a couple days ago.
My wife sent out a gazillion, but we're glad that you're on the list.
So it was news to you.
Well, she told me about it yesterday.
Oh, okay, good,
or
good.
Day
good.
Before yesterday.
Regardless, yeah. I thought it was pretty cool. I'm not gonna lie to you. I thought it was pretty cool. JoeDiffie.com/vinyl. Joe, good luck and good to see you again.
Thank you, man. Appreciate you having me.
Episode 217 here on the Bobbycast.